Going Linux, episode 125, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom. Whether you're new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux.
In today's episode, listener feedback. We hope you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
But first, this word from our sponsor.
Today's episode of Going Linux is brought to you by Audible.com. Right now, to receive your books, you'll need to use Audible's proprietary player in Windows, Windows in a Virtual Machine, or Wine, since they don't have a player that runs natively under Linux. If you have one of those options available to you, then we have a special URL that lets you sign up for a free audiobook and a 14-day free trial.
And if you don't have one of those options available, sign up anyway, and then bug Audible. Tell them we want a port for Linux. And if you're a developer, go ahead, call them up. Tell them you'd like to help them in developing a Linux solution.
And where would they write to Audible, Tom? What email address would they use?
That address would be greatideas, all one word, at audible.com.
Perfect. And the place to go to get our special offer from Audible is audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. You can get a free audiobook and a 14-day trial today by signing up at www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. All one word.
Okay, so that's the end of the commercial?
Yep.
And how was your Christmas, Larry?
Christmas was great. It was rainy here, but other than that, it was not too bad.
No mudslides?
Yours? Not where I am. I'm kind of on flat land here, so not too bad.
Mine was fine. Had a nice big get-together with the family.
Ah, good. Happy times at Christmas time.
All right, and before we get going here, Larry.
Yeah.
And I know I didn't talk to you about this before. Have you used Alias?
Yes, I have.
For those who don't know what Alias is, it's a terminal command, and it lets you define a word as a command. So, Larry, I'm running 10.04, and I thought I would experiment with Alias. And if I type, let's say, Alias space list equals, quote, ls, end quote, anytime I type list, it'll do an ls. It'll list the directory.
Right.
That works fine.
Okay.
But if I try typing something that has spaces in it, and this is supposed to work, such as alias space update equals, quote, sudo apt get update, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It takes everything after sudo and says, that's not a command. Okay, so listeners, what's going on there?
Well, I may have a solution here.
Okay.
Usually when you need to use a space in any sort of command line thing, you would put a backslash in front of the space.
Yeah, but I look online and I don't see that. You know what? I'll try it right now.
Okay, give it a try. That would be my first inkling is to try that.
A-L, oops, get the fingers in the right place. A-L-I-A-S, update. Equals, quote, sudo, backslash.
That's the one that is diagonal from the upper left to the lower right.
Yeah, right. Apt, get.
And you have to put that in front of every space.
Oh, well, let's try it. It didn't object to the definition, so let's try update. Command not found.
Yeah.
It ran everything together. Oh, you know what? I know what I did. That worked.
Okay, good.
Okay, so if you want a space, you can't just put a space. You have to have a backslash, then space.
Right, and that backslash, when you are typing commands at the command line in a terminal, says, use the next character just as I typed it. And so you can use it for spaces, you can use it for semicolons or other things that might indicate the end of a line or a special character like a sure. quote or a double quote or something like that. So you can force the command line to treat it as the character that it is rather than
a space.
As a space in this case. So that's what it's for.
Okay, and I have done that before, and I just didn't think to use it in this case because I was looking at online tutorials on how to use Alias,
mm-hmm.
and by golly, I could copy and paste just what they had, and it wouldn't work.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got lots and lots of email.
Yes, and we have a couple of voicemails as well.
Excellent.
So our first voicemail is from Steve, the door-to-door geek. He likes sending voicemails, and we like receiving voicemails.
Yes, we do.
This was from our Google Voice line, and here's Steve's voicemail.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Tom. This is Steve McLaughlin, Door Geek, calling you from my lovely Linux phone. Yes, Android phone. Can't help it. Gotta love it. Real quick, on the last podcast, Tom was having issues. He was saying E16. I was really hoping he was made of a faux pas, and he meant E17. But a little piece of advice that I'm sure he learned the hard way, when you want to install a supplemental desktop, I always first do it from a live CD just to see how it's going to act and react before I install it on my native OS. Live CDs are my testing ground for any and everything. Everything. Okay, guys, thanks for the fantastic podcast. Please keep it up, and I hope to hear from you guys soon. Thanks for everything. Bye.
Okay, yeah, great advice, Steve. Thanks for that advice. And it was E16. That was what was in the repository. And I charged blindly in and screwed myself. So that's the way it sometimes works out. I do things like that. And you're right. If I had created another user and let that other user, or if I had done it from a live CD, I would not have had the problems that I ran into. But sometimes I get stupid. I did notice that if I clicked on guest session, you know the icon that you click on to log out or shut down?
Yes.
Yeah, one option is guest session. And my guest session, while my normal session was screwed up, the guest session worked perfectly. But, of course, You can't fix anything from a guest session.
Right.
You have no permissions at all. It
doesn't have root permission, right.
Right.
So you want to try it in the guest session.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Or a live CD. Right. Thanks, Steve. Right. I was stupid. You were right.
Thanks, Steve. And our next voicemail is from Jim Kerwin, who has some advice for me about coupon printing software. You remember my experiences with Target?
Oh, I certainly do.
Yeah, so here's some feedback from Jim.
Hey, Larry and Tom. This is the part where I wait while you say, hi, Jim. Dum da
dum 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 dum. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Okay, your mention of the Target coupon printer application sparked an immediate response on this end. Be thankful that you couldn't install the coupon printer. In a world where nothing's free and everyone wants your personal data, our experience is that these coupon printers are, at best, ruses to drop tracking cookies on your system, and, at worst, are vehicles for Trojans. For instance, every Friday, I run SpyBot Search and Destroy and Malwarebytes anti-malware on my wife's XP Pro system, in addition to the antivirus that she uses. Hers is the only Windows box in the house. On Thursday, she had to download a coupon printer from Cold Stone Creamery Ice Cream. I thought it was odd, but, like it, love it, gotta have it, as their motto goes, trumped suspicion. The next day, Malwarebytes found about 6 or 7 tracking cookies left behind by Coldstone's coupon printer. We have Firefox flag and ask us about every cookie that tries to get installed on our systems, and this coupon printer circumvented all that. Needless to say, we uninstalled that coupon printing software pronto. Then, just 2 days ago, I got an email from my sister-in-law, whose Windows 7 system I support remotely through LogMeIn. It turns out that her system had been infected with a bogus antivirus software, which had installed itself with, you guessed it, a coupon printer from a company less reputable than Target, in your case, or Cold Stone Creamery, in my wife's case. This helpful antivirus software offered to disinfect her system for a mere $79.95. It took me over 3 hours to get her system uninfected because the bogus antivirus software had blocked SpyBot, malware bytes, and even the Microsoft malicious software removal app, claiming that each of those programs was trying to contact the internet to upload credit card information. And I had to walk my sister-in-law through the process of booting into safe mode networking and talk her through the various possible fixes because in safe mode, it wasn't possible to connect to her system via LogMeIn. So these coupon printers have now cost me about 3.5 going on 4 hours over the last week or so. Other people are going to disagree, which is their right, but no 10% discount or free scoop of ice cream is going to make me prostitute our machines by making it easier for other folks to track our online activities. As I said, just be thankful that you couldn't use the Target coupon printing software. Thanks for letting me vent, and thanks for a great show.
Oh.
Well, Jim, yeah, that not-so-reputable vendor
yeah,
with the coupon printing software, I was a little leery of that. But yeah, with Target and with Cold Stone Creamery, I thought, well, you know, those companies are pretty good, you know. They're not likely to be putting fake antivirus on my computer, but I realize that there will be tracking cookies. I mean, that's why they do the coupon printing.
You know, and it might not be the ice cream place. They bought that software somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's all about advertising, and it's all about finding what their customers are doing online, and that's what tracking cookies are for.
And getting their credit card numbers and sending them out to God knows where.
Well, that's the not so reputable coupon printing software. But from a marketing and advertising perspective, regardless of what the antivirus and the anti-spam software is telling you, tracking cookies, they are evil from the perspective that they're tracking your behavior, but that's what they're designed to
right.
do, and that's all about marketing and advertising. So they're not evil from the perspective that they're not infecting your computer with bad stuff.
Always.
It's just that,
necessarily,
yeah. Not necessarily. When you're dealing with a reputable company, that's for sure. But when they tell you that they're installing this antivirus software, and you can install it for this fee, and in fact,
yeah,
go ahead and download it from this link. Yeah, that one I wouldn't have fallen for.
Yeah, and whoever invented the cookie gave it way too nice a name.
Yes,
should have called it a pill or something, and then maybe people would be a little more wary.
Yeah.
So thanks, Jim. And oh, Jim, try TeamViewer. You're gonna like it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, next up, we've got a regular email from Mark. And Mark says, hi, Tom and Larry. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
I feel your frustration on episode 121 about Target's choice to only provide online coupons using coupon printing software that does not run under Linux. I deal with the same issues because my wife wants to print online coupons all the time. Hey, Mark, listen to the previous.
Yeah.
The issue here is that coupons, like money, are supposed to be a scarce resource. For instance, what if you could just print coupons for free toothbrushes and that cleaned out the drugstore of their stock? That would not benefit the manufacturer, nor would it necessarily make you loyal to the brand. However, one coupon for a free toothbrush might leave you wanting more. Oh, I see your point there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he continues, the coupon printer plugins for Windows try to restrict you to printing one or two coupons. They are careful to check out that they're going to an actual printer rather than a PDF file. Each coupon has a serial number and an ID number that can be verified online by the store, though in practice it's not. These coupon printing plugins are complicated because they do so many checks to prevent copies from being made. However, these measures can be circumvented, and coupon piracy is so much a concern that a few stores refuse to honor online coupons. For my wife, I installed Windows XP in a virtual box on her laptop so she can print coupons and stream Netflix movies. The rest of the time, she uses Linux Mint without any trouble for Facebook and email and whatever else she needs to do. It's really a shame that DRM on coupons and movies force you to use Windows. They could rewrite their software for Linux, but that really goes against the spirit of Linux, which is openness and sharing. However, I believe these programs will move to Linux when there is a large enough percentage of the customers using Linux for them to care. Mark. Okay, so there's a lot of ways to look at this, Larry.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mark, you're absolutely correct from my perspective that one of the reasons they're limiting the printing of the coupons is to prevent fraud and mass duplication of coupons.
Sure.
And that sort of stuff. So I fully understand it. But my point is, if they really want to address the maximum number of customers out there, they should be creating software that runs in Linux. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation.
Yeah.
Until we have enough people using Linux, they're not going to develop the software. But until the software that people want to use is developed for Linux, there will be people who don't switch to Linux just because of that. So I'm making a point more than anything.
Well, when they do develop the software, keeping Jim's voicemail in mind, I'm not going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, me neither.
So there's that chicken and egg thing again.
Okay, well, thanks, Mark, for that email. And our next email is from Martin. Martin writes, "Hi, Larry and Tom."
Hi, Martin. Martin.
I guess the graphic for the Linux timeline, so he's referring to our episode where we talked about
Linux
various
through the years.
Yeah, Linux through the years. He says, I guess the graphic for the Linux timeline originally came from here, and he provides a link. He says, there, you can also get it as a PNG or compressed file. And in fact, it is already a newer version. The graphic has the file version in the upper left. Then your link, which points to a 10.9, and the current is 10.11. Okay, the differences for sure do not change the world. However, I would recommend changing your link in the show notes to point to the version that seems to be kept out of date. And we have made that change, Martin, in our show notes so that it points directly to the original source rather than to the article in which I originally found the graphic. By the way, thanks for the link to the site showing BIOS access keys for different manufacturers. That helps supporting people over the phone who are not able to read fast enough.
Yeah.
Best regards and keep up the good work. P.S. On each episode, again, I enjoy that you speak clearly and not too fast. For Ubuntu UK podcast, I sometimes have difficulties to get everything, especially when they start joking. They sometimes get really fast and into slang, but I cannot complain because it is primarily the UK loco team and not sure how many listeners from outside the UK and the US. Martin. Well, Martin, thanks very much.
Yep.
And again, thanks for giving us the kudos on not speaking too quickly.
And by the way, before I joined this podcast and I was listening to other Linux podcasts, I was a beginner, and it really bugged me that they would use letters such as GUI or GUI.
Well, yeah.
What the heck? What is that? So when we run into that, we try to remember to explain for the newer listeners what those letters and terms mean.
Of course.
Okay, well, next up we have Lewis. Lewis says, "Hi, Larry and Tom."
Hiya, Lewis. Hi, Lewis.
"I was listening to podcast 119 and was happy to hear about your sister unplugging from the Matrix and installing Linux. Then you said, and I'm going to finish up that install this coming weekend and doing the restricted extras repositories. etc. What immediately came to my mind was, why all that work? I recently installed Linux Mint 10, and this weekend I will be learning how to use MonoDevelop and other fun stuff. I have nothing to set up in my distro. I invite you to use Mint, but I must warn you, once you take the Mint pill, there is no turning back. Outstanding work, guys. Look forward to meeting you at Scale 9X. Lewis. You won't be meeting me. You'll probably see Larry there, though.
Yeah, I probably will. And it was your sister we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So Lewis's point is, if you just simply switch to Mint, you don't have to worry about all those restricted extras. It's all set up for
sure,
you.
Sure, sure. Well, I had other things to do, too. I wanted to give her some great programs that I use all the time, and set up repositories and all that good stuff. So,
right. And it's just good practice if you're going to be the support person for someone that you give them mm-hmm. the same distribution that you're using.
Right.
So that you don't have to switch between the two to give them support.
Right. And I have tried Mint, just the live CD, and it looks beautiful. It works great. And people rave about it. I just, you know how it is. You start using one thing and you sort of stay with it.
Yeah.
Change is difficult for humans.
Well, and we'll see how Unity does in Ubuntu 11.04, I guess it is. And we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
And maybe you and I will be switching to Mint at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see.
Rats leaving the ship.
Anyhow, Rob has our next email. He says, okay. Hi, guys.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Rob. I was listening to episode 119. Yes, I know. I'm a little behind on the podcasts. Well, Rob, we're a little behind on the emails, too,
yeah,
so that's
no
fair.
No kidding.
And hearing you talk about what is that email address doing in the SSH command. This is a shorthand way of logging as a user other than your current user on the remote system. SSH space username at hostname is much easier to remember than SSH-L space username space hostname. And this is in reference to the episode where we were talking about SSH, and in fact, we've had other advice from other folks on this as well.
Right, sure.
So Rob continues, additionally, the difference between the dash capital Y and dash capital X switches is that the dash capital Y switch gives you trusted X access, which has some additional abilities over the standard untrusted X forwarding. Regards, Rob. Okay, Rob. Well, thanks.
Thanks, Rob. I'm not really sure what all of that means because I really haven't experimented with SSH yet, but I should.
Yeah. If you need it, it's very useful. I rarely need it, so.
Okay.
Not all that useful for me.
And our next email is from Tony. He says, hi, guys. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
I'm playing miniature golf on my computer, and I accidentally hit something that made the game come up out of range. How do I bring my game up again? Regards, Tony.
And I responded to Tony on email. I wrote, there are 13 different golf games in the Ubuntu repositories. I'm sure each miniature golf game works differently. Perhaps you could try doing a Google search for the name of the program, the word Linux, and the words out of range. Or you could see if there's a help topic from within the game that might help you out. And we didn't hear back from Tony, so we assume that my email helped him fix his problem.
Yeah, let's assume that.
Yeah.
Larry, I think the first thing I'd try is ripping the game out by its roots. I mean, every last bit of it. And then reinstalling to see if that does it.
Well, I suspect that out of range means that the ball went out of range on the golf game.
Yeah, but it's remembering because he can't get back into it. So
yeah, maybe reinstall
file.
Would help.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe there's a bug. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I think Tony's actually using Linux Mint. But again, the Ubuntu repositories are the ones that Mint points to for some of these things, at least.
Sure.
So we'll see if we hear anything back from Tony. We haven't so far, so hopefully
all
he's
right.
Got it fixed. Our next email is from...
Oh, that's a tough one.
Yeah, it's P-P-E-V-E-L. So I think it's P-Pevel or P-P-Evil.
Let's
or
just go with like Pevel.
Pevel, okay. Greetings, Tom and Larry. Greetings,
hey,
Pevel. I love your show. You guys are great. Always positive, unlike many other Linux podcasts with snide and sarcastic hosts. I've been using Linux for about 8 years now with increasing success. Your podcast is often helpful and always enjoyable, Pevel. Well, thanks very much for the wonderful comment.
Yeah, thanks, Pevel. That's very nice of you to say. We just bask in that sort of thing.
Yes.
Okay, and on deck we've got Michael, who says, "Hi, Larry and Tom." Hiya, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
I listen to your podcast in Trinidad and Tobago via the open source Miro application. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful application that runs across all major platforms, including Linux, and is the tool that first introduced me to podcasts, both video and audio, around 2 years ago. Up to this point in time, I have not come across an equivalent, not even iTunes, which does not run on Linux. Anyway, I did not write to talk about Miro, just wanted to let you know it featured your podcast and introduced me to your very informative and entertaining show. I recently came up with a niggling issue with Dropbox that I wanted to share with other users. I have a home desktop computer running Linux, Mint 9, an office laptop that dual boots to Windows XP and OpenSUSE 11.3, and a personal HP netbook with WinXP, to which I recently Wubi installed Ubuntu 10.04 LTS. And for those who don't know about Wubi, Wubi is a very, very easy way to install Linux on a Windows machine. So you'll have a dual boot, but it doesn't bother your Windows install at all.
Right.
And Ubuntu 10.04 LTS, that LTS means long-term support.
And it looks like Michael installed the netbook edition of 10.04.
Oh, okay. Yep, that's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he goes on. Dropbox is installed on the Windows XP part of my portable computers and the Mint desktop. Everything was working fine. The issue I had was that I decided to install Dropbox on the OpenSUSE partition of my Office laptop. The laptop actually has three partitions, an NTFS partition with the Windows operating system and applications, the Linux partition, and an NTFS partition which holds all my data. From Windows, Dropbox is installed as... and he quotes, "My Dropbox," under My Documents. However, when I set up Dropbox in OpenSUSE, it installs the folder as simply Dropbox, which would basically be a duplicate of the My Dropbox folder in the same partition. Ideally, it would be useful for both WinXP and Linux operating systems to sync to the same folder, but there's no option in the delivered app to do so. I think I came across a solution, though. After Googling the issue, I realized that it is a known problem with WinXP/Linux dual booting systems. The solution is for the Windows application that allows changing the name of the folder from My Dropbox to Dropbox, thus allowing the Linux app to sync to it. The tool to facilitate this is found in the Dropbox Wiki website, and he gives a link to that. We'll put it in the show notes. There is no tool in Linux, however, to change the Dropbox folder name to My Dropbox. Hope this helps others who want to try dual booting and need to use Dropbox on both operating systems. Your show rocks. Never mind that my country is famous for Calypso.
All right. Well, and I responded back to Michael and I wrote him, thanks for the information. I didn't know that the Windows version of Dropbox had a utility for changing the default folder name. For your information, the reason Linux doesn't have such a utility is that it doesn't need one. Right-click on the Dropbox icon in the notification area and select Preferences. You'll find a button labeled Move in the dialog box that allows you to relocate the Dropbox folder to any other folder on your hard drive, including one named My Dropbox, if you like. It's great to know that you like the podcast. Thanks for listening, Larry.
Right, Larry. And I think you and Michael might both be right, because I believe it's the most recent version of Dropbox that has that preference.
That feature, yes.
Right.
And in fact, Michael responded back to us.
Okay.
And he said, thanks for the quick response, Larry. I have to advise, though, that moving the folder is not the issue. If you move Dropbox to the My Dropbox folder, instead of syncing, it creates another folder called Dropbox under the My Dropbox folder. Then what happens is that all the data that's already in the My Dropbox folder is automatically synced to the Dropbox folder as well, effectively doubling the size of My Dropbox. To explain, if I have 10 folders in My Dropbox with 100 files total, in Linux, I then move Dropbox under My Dropbox folder, the latter would now have 11 folders with 200 files total, so essentially doubling the size of the folder and duplicating all the files. The solution is to change the name of the folder to one that matches the naming convention of the application on the other operating system, so that when you move one Dropbox folder to the parent of the other Dropbox folder, the application would realize that there is already a folder with the same name and thus sync correctly. Thus far, I'm only aware of the Windows renaming utility, so the correction would be as follows. Boot into Windows, run the utility to change the name of My Dropbox to Dropbox. Check to make sure that the files placed there automatically sync as expected. Boot to Linux, install Dropbox, and set the folder, or if it was previously installed, move the folder, to My Documents, or whatever parent of the Dropbox folder in step one is. Test by moving the files in the Dropbox folder structure and ensure there is no duplication. Hope this clarifies the situation more clearly. And I have to admit, Michael, that I hadn't tried this myself, so when I did try it, you're absolutely correct. It doesn't actually move it to the folder you want it to when you're working with this in Linux. It actually moves the folder into the folder you want and calls it Dropbox, just as you suggested. So your suggestion is going to work best. Thanks, Michael.
Yep. Thank you, Michael. And Michael wrote back later. Hi, Larry and Tom.
Hi, Michael.
Michael, I wrote some weeks ago on the issue facing Dropbox users who use dual boot systems, Windows and Linux, where the main Dropbox folder in Windows is named My Dropbox and the main folder in Linux is named Dropbox. I also wrote that there's a tool provided by the Dropbox Wiki site called Dropbox Path and explained how it would resolve the issue. Well, I downloaded the tool and did attempt to use it, but it was not initially successful. The tool was designed to run from the command line with the parameters to the new desired location, e.g. /dropbox/dropbox. However, I kept getting folder access denied messages. In retrospect, I think this is because the folder from which I was running the application was also in the Dropbox folder structure. So,
yeah, that could very well be.
Yeah. So I searched for another tool and actually found another one, this time a GUI version, graphical user interface, that would work on Windows, Linux, or Mac environments. It's based on a Python script. It's called PY Dropbox Path, and he gives a link for where to find it. We'll put that in the show notes. I downloaded all the files in this link to a folder on my hard disk, including the DLL files from, and he gives another link. There were just 5 steps. Exit the Dropbox client on the tray, right-click, then exit. back up your Dropbox. I actually created a new folder with the desired name Dropbox and copied all the files and folders from my Dropbox to it. Step 3, put the new location of the Dropbox folder in the New Location field. You could also graphically browse to select it, so I selected a new folder named Dropbox. Click on Save New Location, restart the Dropbox client, and that's it. I explored the folders and noted that the new Dropbox folder had a logo on it, and the application continued syncing with other files I had modified on another system as if nothing had happened. I restarted the system and booted the OpenSUSE Linux partition, started the Dropbox client after ensuring that it still pointed to the document folder called Dropbox, and all was fine. I now have two different operating systems on the same system syncing to the same folder. I appreciate all the tips, tricks, and suggestions shared by both yourselves and the listeners on the Going Linux podcast, as well as Computer America. Because of this, I am sharing my experiences so that others on your show can benefit the way I have. Keep podcasting. Michael Amon, the computer guy in Trinidad and Tobago. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Michael. Very nice.
Well done. Good research.
Next up, Mike provided us with a link. He says, speaking as a fairly recent Linux convert, although I suspect my skill level is a bit higher than the average bear, I found the Ubuntu Stack Exchange to be well worth a bookmark. And he shares a link that is askubuntu.com. Share the love, right, Mike? Well, thanks, Mike.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Larry, did you look at this?
I did, and it's quite interesting, and it is essentially a forum that allows you to ask questions, get them answered, and it's got a unique interface that's kind of reminiscent of Ubuntu itself. It's got nice big green dots and red dots and white dots.
Excellent.
Very cheery. Easy to read, too, so it's great.
Yeah. Okay, up next, Sam in Australia provided some help for Mark in Sweden. Sam says, hello.
Hello. Hello, Sam.
I'm a new listener to your podcast, and I thought I could add some information to an emailer that you had. I think it was a person from Sweden who updated to Ubuntu 10.10 and now could not get good speeds through his wireless connection. Well, I had the same problem after I upgraded. You spoke about it on your latest podcast, the one that featured Computer America radio show. I searched around the net and found this command, which I enter on the terminal when I turn on my laptop and reset something, and I get a full speed through wireless again. The command is sudo iwconfig space eth1 space power space off, and we'll put that in the show notes. Mm-hmm. I am just a learner to Linux, and I hope this command helps. It seems to work for me. I like the show. I am from Australia. Thanks for your work. Sam. Well, thank you, Sam. I'm sure that will help some people.
Right. And Mark actually responded as I had forwarded on Sam's advice to him.
Okay.
And Mark said, hey, Larry. Hey, Mark. Sent you an email about your suggestion, which didn't work, but I thought I would give you an overall update. I went back to 10.04 and then installed Windows 7 on my second partition. Everything was fine for a day, and then the updates in Ubuntu came and wiped out my grub too. Needless to say, nothing helped, and I couldn't get my dual boot back. So I went back to square one, installed 7 on my partition 1, 10.10 on partition 2, then added a large partition for files I would use in both operating systems. Now I have my dual boot, but like I said, the network card doesn't go above 2 megabits. I logged a question at ubuntu.com, and then after going back and forth with someone, giving them the text of various config files, it has been logged as a bug number 676878 relating to the exchange concerning question 134255. Still frustrated, at least I have a working dual boot, but a slow internet on 10.10. Thanks for all the help, and hopefully someone will come with a fix. Mark. And if I remember correctly, Mark had written in after that to tell us that an update that he received on 10.10 actually fixed the problem. Or maybe it was someone else, but I'm pretty sure it was Mark. Anyway, thanks, Mark.
Okay, thanks for that, Mark. And next up, we have Chester. And Chester asked, can you do a show on media aggregators? Tell us your recommendation. Here's a list of media aggregators. And he gives a link to Linux App Finder that we will put in the show notes. And he says these were not included in the above list, and he gives us two more, both at SourceForge. And, well, Chester, I guess we will look into that. I'm not even sure what a media aggregator is. What is that, Larry?
A media aggregator would be something that actually brings in your audio files or video files. It's essentially podcast receiving software.
Okay, so a podcatcher or something
yes.
like Miro.
Right. And now we have a Gone Linux email. This email is from Nancy. Nancy writes, hi, guys.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. And she wrote that into her email just in case we forgot to say hi. So thank you for that, Nancy. Well, being sort of trilingual, I am not exactly a Linux noob, but I am far from an expert either. I have SUSE on a standalone machine because we're going to be moving some of our servers to SLES, which is SUSE Linux Enterprise Server, in the near future. And that's a company laptop. I never had a problem with infections on any of my machines, ever, and still haven't. I have a laptop running Vista with no issues whatsoever, and one running 7 with no issues whatsoever. With a Core i5 processor, that thing is blazing fast. I have a virtual XP machine on that, using the Windows native virtual machine software, but it really, really, really doesn't want to allow any sort of non-Microsoft machine. I may later put VMware on it, but for the time being, I have something else going on. The SUSE is on a really basic machine, one that we would never consider issuing for standard use. I also have a company-issued Mac, and I have Parallels on it running Windows XP. Most of what I'm doing on the Mac is simply so I can be up to speed on supporting what is used here. The Parallels configuration is one example. SUSE was just plain awful on a Parallels virtual machine, and I never came back to try anything else. I have Mint either on an old Toshiba that needs a new display or on the Vista machine, can't remember which, possibly both because the virtual machines were in the My Documents folder that I just copied over one from the other. The Ubuntu I have on the Vista laptop is some pug ugly bird on the wallpaper, so I'm guessing that it's Ibis. Maybe Intrepid Ibex? I'm suspecting that's what she has.
Yeah.
That was the last Ubuntu distribution I tried. Parallels will let a user virtualize a disk for an ISO image. I think most virtualization tools will. So I grabbed Ubuntu 10.10, and wow, yes, really put a lot of emphasis on that. Wow, that's a really nice interface. And I mean, even from the install page on, it's almost elegant. Getting the software I wanted to have handy was so much easier than with Ibex. They've really put a lot of great work into the operating system since I last used it. Man, it makes SUSE 11 look just plain clunky. I haven't looked at Mint since Gloria. I might have to try that later on. Because of the sort of work I do, going exclusively Linux will never be an option. But I have it as an alternative to offer clients of my side job is really nice. Shameless plug here, I go by This Geek I Know website under construction, but the domain is all mine. After I finish my Mac technician training, I believe the company is going to encourage me to look into Linux training. Your show has given me a lot of confidence to experimenting into areas I haven't looked at before, and the show on remote access was a great example of that. Keep up the great show. I can't think of any esoteric changes to suggest. The content and chemistry between the two of you is going to be good enough to keep me listening, and I really doubt there's going to be anything that would make me want to quit listening. By the way, do you ever hear from the original co-host? Just curious. Tom's doing a great job, but I was just wondering. Nancy.
Thanks, Nancy.
Yeah, thanks. Very, very interesting use of Linux mixed in with all kinds of other operating systems
as part of
your job. Yeah, and just to answer your question about Serge, my original co-host, I exchange emails with him once in a while, not too often, and he's doing very well. He's moved from California to Arizona. He's still in a relatively high position in the university he's in, and still doing research and using Linux. So he's doing well.
Great. And as far as improvements in Ubuntu, I'm right with you there, Nancy. As you probably know, I recently moved from 9.04 to 10.04. And what to my wondering eyes should appear, but my touch screen started working. It never did before.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a Hewlett-Packard with a touch screen, and now I can actually use it.
Yeah, that's great.
And next up, I have a software pick.
And
it's an old pick. It's something that I've rediscovered. And it's transcoding software. So, for instance, if you've got an AVI file and you want to be able to watch that movie on your iPod or your Rockbox machine or something in that order, it'll do the transcoding for you. And it's a graphical user interface, very easy to use. And it's called WinFF, W-I-N-F-F. And that you can find WinFF in the repositories if you want to try it. It's a pretty cool little program.
Yeah, and that's the Ubuntu repositories, of course.
That's right.
And since you've mentioned WinFF, I have used that in the past. Here's another one that I've just discovered recently, and I think I discovered this at the prompting of one of our listeners. It's software called Arista Transcoder. And if I remember correctly, I pulled it out of the repositories as well. It may not be in the 10.04 repositories, but it's
spelled
A-R-I-S-T-A, Arista.
I-S-T-A. There it is.
And it's a graphical transcoder that does very similar to what you talked about, Tom. And it's received some recent good publicity as well. So another alternative.
Excellent. All right, I'm installing that right now. I'll try it out.
And in fact, you know how these things go. It may use the same transcoding engine on the back end as the one you're using, but we'll see. Let us know how that works, Tom, because I haven't had to transcode anything since installing it. And if you're using it, let us know.
I sure will. Okay, well, I think that about wraps it up, Larry.
It does. And our next episode is Computer America number 34. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information, for detailed instructions, and for screencasts and illustrations.
And speaking of Computer America, Larry, is it just me or does it seem like Carrie's kind of coming around to Linux?
Yeah, you know, in the last episode, I thought he did an excellent commercial for Going Linux and another one for Linux in general. I think, I don't know, maybe I'll just cut that out and use it as a promo for, you know, with his permission, of course. But he's come around a lot and had a lot of good things to say in this last episode. Maybe it's just the holiday season and the positive spirit.
Maybe he'll come over from the dark side yet, huh?
Maybe so. The true test will be when he starts using Linux.
Yeah. And anyway, listeners, you can email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the podcast Alley button to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site.
You can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. And if you want to just leave us a voicemail, you can do that at 1-904-468-7889. And that on a U.S. phone keyboard is 1-904-4-OUR-TUX.
And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. We are Going Linux, all one word. You can download the episodes from the website, or you can use the player to play them right on the show notes page.
You can also get future episodes delivered directly to your computer automatically as soon as new episodes are available. For instructions on how to subscribe to a podcast, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Larry Bushy, the host of the Going Linux podcast, which is a free audio on demand you can listen to through your computer, or you can download it and put it on an MP3 player, run it to a CD, listen to it in your car, to learn more about the Linux operating system. It's what's wonderful about that, you ever have to call somebody for support, and you end up getting that guy in another country with the accent you can't understand, and you ultimately figure out you're smarter than he is. But with Linux, when you need support, it's a community-driven support system for the most part. And there are paid versions of Linux, and the paid versions are paid because of the support that they offer. But I think the majority of Linux users do so, especially residential Linux users for sure, take advantage of the community support. And the Going Linux podcast is just one very small example of the type of support that's available. And in fact, during the show now, in the second hour, we're addressing some of your Linux questions sent on to Going Linux Podcast and Larry. Because generally, when somebody asks a question, in most cases, there's probably 100 other people at least with the same exact question who just didn't bother asking. So the idea is that, and because the podcast is made available for years after it's recorded, it may not be a problem you have yet, but we'll have one day. So it's always there.
New music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.